Vaydaber Moshe el Roshei Hamatot Livnei Yisrael Lemor Ze Hadavar Asher Tziva Hashem Ish Ki Yidor Neder Lashem O Hishava Shivua Le'esor Isor Al Nafsho Lo Yachel Divaro Kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Matot, recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 19th of Tammuz, 5771, July 21st. And being the 19th of Tammuz, we are into the period known as the 3 weeks between Shivas Arba Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, a mournful period for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Consequently, I've removed the music, except for an a cappella piece, which we will play, Emir Tzashem, and that will be our policy during the three-week period. Right down to business, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim k'raticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmorya, Adonai mi'amod, ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi'shomerim l'aboker, shomerim l'aboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. I don't know if my voice caught on the name of this week's Sedra Matot. It is much more common to say Matot Mas'eh. We have in our 54 Sedras, let's take a step back and look at the whole picture. The practice of Jews throughout the world is to read the entire Torah in the course of a year. The Torah is begun from Bereshit on the Shabbat after Simchat Torah, and then throughout the year until Simchat Torah, when we read the last of the Parshiot, the last of the weekly Sedras, Vizot HaBracha, and immediately begin the first part of Bereshit. That's how the yearly cycle of the Torah reading goes. In order to accomplish that, there are 54 Parshiot HaShavua, 54 weekly portions, 7 pairs of which, that's 14 Sedras that pair up to 7 pairs, are sometimes read combined and sometimes read separately. The reason for that is we have a variable number of available Shabbatot for the Torah reading. We have as few as 50 and as many as 54, 55, and there are other factors that come into play. The major increase is from a 12-month year to a 13-month year, extra Shabbatot. Then there is how many Shabbatot are preempted from the regular weekly portion by Chagim that fall on the Shabbat. For example, this coming year, Yom Kippur will be Shabbat. Therefore, we won't read Parshat HaShavua. We will read the special reading for Yom Kippur. So now we are one Shabbat less in the total of the year, and a Sedra as a result will be doubled. A pair will be doubled. In any event, to cut the long story a little bit shorter, Matot Maseh is the pair, or are the two of the pair, that are most often combined, to the tune of close to 90% of the time outside of Israel, and close to 80% of the time in Israel. What that translates to is that when we have a 13-month year, like this one, that begins on Thursday, like this one, then Matot Maseh will be separated all over the world. There's another year type, like this one, also 13-month, and also beginning on a Thursday, so too Matot Maseh will be separated, and that accounts for a little over 10% of the time. In Israel, we have an additional 10% of the time for another two-year types, also 13-month years, and specifically ones in which Pesach is a Friday night. In other words, Shabbat through Friday are the 7 days of Pesach in Israel. And that following day, Shabbat, is a regular weekly portion. But in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, where there are 8 days of Pesach, you will have, in those kind of years, Shabbat through the following Shabbat, which means two Shabbatot in a row will be preempted by special readings for the holiday. And therefore, we in Israel will jump one weekly portion ahead of Chutz La'aretz, and we have no opportunity to catch up, or to let them catch up, so to speak, except to split Matot Maseh well into the summer. That's the other situation. If you followed that, fine, and if not, it's not the most important thing in the world. The fact of the matter is that Matot Maseh is a huge double portion, and broken up into the two separate portions, they become reasonably full-length sedras. Now to Matot itself. Several topics, we'll see how many we could accomplish. At the opening of the show, I read not just the first verse in Matot, but purposely the second one as well, so that we could introduce the topic and I could say a few things about it. Moshe speaks to the tribal leaders of the people of Israel and says, "Stand by, this is what God has commanded." Now, of course, all of the Torah was commanded to all of the people, and the tribal leaders received the instructions first, and then it was transmitted to the people. But for various reasons given in the commentaries, this particular topic is introduced as Moshe speaking to the tribal leaders. And what is the topic? A person who takes a vow to God or swears something, forbidding something to himself, lo yachel divaro, he shall not profane his words. Rather, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, everything that comes out of his mouth, meaning in the form of a pledge, a vow, a promise, an oath, etc., he has to do. You have the prohibition, thou shalt not profane thy word, and the positive command, you shall fulfill what you have promised and pledged. That's the opener of the topic of nidarim, vows. What follows is a series of psukim explaining that there are two situations when a vow can be canceled, annulled. One is a young girl between the age of 12 and 12 and a half, when she has a halachic status called na'ara. If on the day that her father hears of her vow. It does not have to be on the day that she took the vow, but it could be the day that he hears of the vow. He has the Torah's authority to pronounce that vow null and void. So if a 12-year-old girl vows never to wear lipstick or to pierce her ear, whatever, the father, on the day and only on the day that he hears of the vow, can say, I disband, annul that vow, and it's no longer a binding vow on the girl. Similarly, but with differences, a husband, on the day that he hears of his wife's vow, only on the day that he hears it, if he lets the day go by, he cannot cancel it anymore. On that day, if it is a vow that has something to do with him, and not just personal for the wife, then he has the authority to annul such a vow. That process, both by father of a daughter and husband of a wife, is called Hafarat Nidarim, and is spelled out clearly in the Torah. And that's it for the Torah on the topic of vows. Now we have something else. Every year, Erev Rosh Hashanah, or sometime during the 10 days between, from Rosh Hashanah till Yom Kippur, Erev Yom Kippur, it is a tradition for people to appear before a Beit Din, a panel of three, in order to nullify vows, mostly inadvertent ones, ones that one tends to forget. It's a whole complicated process. It's called Hatarat Nidarim, release from vows. And I'll give you an example, because it's not just Rosh Hashanah time. That's the default general one, related also to Kol Nidre at the beginning of Yom Kippur. But let's give you a practical example. A person is trying to lose weight. His nemesis, if that's the proper word, is chocolate chip cookies. He could pretty much resist everything else, but when he sees beautiful homemade chocolate chip cookies wherever he goes, he can't control himself. So he decides to up things a notch, not just stam dieting, but he's going to promise that he will not eat a chocolate chip cookie ever. And it's working. He doesn't eat chocolate chip cookies. The temptation gets less and less. And eventually, he drops the weight he wanted, and he's now on a healthy maintenance of his eating habits, which include an occasional chocolate chip cookie, if he would like. But he vowed not to eat chocolate chip cookies. Then one day he's at a party, and he absentmindedly takes up a chocolate chip cookie, makes a bracha, and starts eating it. And then remembers his vow. I might be giving you more detail than is necessary, but there is a point in all of this. He now has a situation where he has violated a vow, and by the way, the reason Judaism frowns upon vows is that it adds an unnecessary stumbling block to the person who has more than enough things that he's not allowed to do. And now he made upon himself an additional prohibition. Not a smart thing to do. You don't want to eat chocolate chip cookies? Don't. But you put it in a vow, you're going to get yourself into trouble. And I just combined in this hypothetical situation two possibilities here. So we'll take each one separately. In the case where it no longer is imperative that the person not have chocolate chip cookies, and he's now well in control of himself, he goes before a Beit Din and says, look, 3 years ago I made a vow not to eat chocolate chip cookies ever. I was a little horrified at the weight that I had, and I wanted to drop. And this was my way of inducing myself to control. And had I realized that I would get down to my desirable weight and be able to eat an occasional chocolate chip cookie without problems, I never would have put it in the form of a vow. On that kind of basis, the panel of three can release the person from his vow. Similarly, to appear before a Beit Din and say, I violated a vow yesterday, had I realized that this would include even accidental, even when it doesn't matter, and I didn't really mean it when I said it, and I was only upset that I had gained weight, and had I been in full faculties of my mind, I would not have put it in the form of a vow. I would have said b'li neder, without a neder. On that basis, you can be undone, and it has the beneficial extra of erasing the violation of the day before. You take a vow on Sunday, you violate it on Monday, and you unbind yourself from it on Tuesday, and Monday was no longer any kind of violation. Now, this is not a haphazard thing. You can't get out of just any neder. But there are a myriad of things that people say in the course of a year and commitments that they make without realizing how binding it is. I'll meet you on the corner of so-and-so and so-and-so tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And something came up, or you overslept, or you had to take care of something, or you were called away in an emergency. You profaned your word. You didn't keep your word. That's a serious thing. And if it's possible, without my going into further detail here, to unbind oneself from the commitment of the neder, not the commitment to do something, then it's good to do. Now, the point that I'm getting at for all of this is that the Torah says if a person takes a vow, a promise, a pledge, an oath, he must keep it. And he's not allowed to profane his word. Only exceptions, the father with the daughter, the husband with the wife, with all of the details, which I haven't gone into. Nowhere in the written Torah does it say anything about the ability to unbind oneself from certain vows. And yet, hatarat nidarim, release from vows, carries equal halachic authority to the binding nature of a vow. What does that mean? The answer is simple, but very, very important. The answer is Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. The oral law, as embodied by the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Talmud, and much of subsequent rabbinic literature, contains many things, but a significant part of the oral law is the transmission orally of that which God taught Moshe to teach the people about the written word. The written word is not the total of the Torah. It is part of the Torah, and it needs its inseparable companion, known as Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, in order to make heads or tails of it. Occasionally, it does more than explain. It actually presents us with something which does not have a grounding in the written text, such as Hatarat Nedarim. But without our firm commitment and belief to the concept of Torah Sheba'al Peh, there would be no way to unbind a person from a vow. That's not a rabbinic concoction. That is part and parcel of Torah law, albeit not in the written portion of the Torah. Now, this created an interesting situation in history where you had Tzedokim, or Karaites, who accept the written word of the Torah as binding and do not accept the oral law. They have no Hatarat Nedarim. They take a vow. It doesn't matter what excuse they offer, good or whatever, for I wish I wouldn't have said it. I wouldn't have said it if so and so. It doesn't matter. Because the concept of being able to unbind oneself from a neder is part of the oral law. You don't accept the oral law, you're stuck with whatever you say, even if it's ridiculous. I will not talk to you ever again. That could be said in anger, and that certainly is a kind of neder which our oral law explains doesn't even need release. It's not a valid promise. Because people don't mean that when they say it. That's anger motivating those words. But if you take the literal meaning of the words in the Torah, Kechol hayotzei mipiv ya'aseh, whatever comes out of your mouth, you shall do, then you got to do it. And there's no two ways about it. This is an example, but a very significant example, of the inseparable nature of the written word and the oral law. And it is, to a great extent, based on belief. I believe with all my heart in the authority of the oral law. Can I prove it to you? All kind of proofs that come from the Torah, but, you know, other people can shrug them away. When the Torah speaks of ritual slaughter, it says, God says, as I commanded Moshe. Well, where does it say anywhere in the written Torah how to go about ritual slaughter? It's not there. The details are part of the oral law. But the Torah says all that God commanded. That's part of our basis of what we point to in the Torah, among many other things, that there is a binding nature to the oral law. Hold that thought, or maybe don't hold it, store it someplace. We'll be right back. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Matot, beginning of the 3 weeks. I would like to play a track which is not only acceptable for the 3 weeks, because it is a cappella, or as they say in Hebrew, vocali. Guess where they get that word from. But the particular song, not just the melody, but the words themselves, Imesh Kachech Yerushalayim, we've played this in the past, are very appropriate since the Mishnah tells us that on the 17th of Tammuz, 2 days ago, Huvka'a Ha'ir, the city of Jerusalem, was breached. That was followed 3 weeks later by the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And it gives the flavor to this whole period. We talk of city of Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash, or Zion and Jerusalem. All of Israel gets included in there also, but the focus is on Yerushalayim. So we have this song, and when we finish with it, we will go back to Parshat Matot. And I hope to also have some time to talk about some of the practices of the 3 weeks, not so much for the details, which will be there, but for the concept, maybe, that stands behind them. portion of the Nidarim, the Torah goes back to continue that which was left over from the end, the beginning of Parshat Pinchas, and there was a whole digression there, and that is the battle against Midian. The way God says it to Moshe now is gather up an army, 1,000 per Shevet per tribe, and after the battle, that's it for you. You'll be ready to die. An interesting observation at the beginning is God speaks to Moshe saying, Nekom nikmat b'nei Yisrael, take vengeance for the children of Israel against the Midianites, and afterwards you will die. Vayomer Moshe el ha'am, Moshe says to the people, Lemor, saying, Hecholtzu Me'itachem anashim latzava, draft, or gather an army from amongst you, and we will do battle against Midian, latet nikmat Hashem b'Midian, to take the vengeance of God against Midian. So, one of the commentaries makes the following observation. If Moshe is told, fight against Midian, and then you will die, the people could say, we don't want our beloved leader to die, so we're not going to fight against Midian. And especially if God calls it the vengeance of the people of Israel, so the people of Israel say, we'll let this one go by in order to keep our leader alive. When Moshe says to the people, gather up the conscripts for the army, he calls it Nikmat Hashem, the vengeance for God. That a person is not going to say, I don't want to participate. 12,000 men are selected for this battle, and the Torah tells us of the successful victory that the people of Israel had over Midian, killing not only the people, but five kings of the different city-states in Midian, and Bilam. Bilam dies by the sword, the Torah makes a point of saying, which is ironic, because the weapon of choice that he and Balak had against the people of Israel was the word, not the sword. And commentaries play on that, and they say that the weapon of the Jewish people is the power of speech, the weapon of the rest of the world is the sword, or its variation, and Bilam and Balak went to fight us with our key weapon, we went to fight them with theirs, and Bilam fell by the sword. So that's the point the Torah makes. The side question that commentaries ask is, if you look at the end of Balak, the problem was Moab and Midian. Moab and Midian teamed up to fight against Bnei Israel, teamed up to hire Bilam to curse the people, teamed up to seduce the men of Israel to the orgiastic worship of Baal Peor, and yet the war of vengeance is directed against Midian, not against Moab. Commentaries suggest that Moab was a clean kind of enemy. They were afraid of Israel, they were afraid of being overridden by them, and they fought. And we beat them, and that's fine. But it's not the kind of war that we would follow up with a wiping out of the nation. Midian joined in this fight because they wanted to destroy the people of Israel. They had no tactical reason, strategic reason for wanting to do this. It was based on a hatred, which we know very well throughout Jewish history, and it's that type of enemy that we will be commanded to strike out against. The Torah then discusses the spoils of war that were brought back from Midian, and the division between the men that fought and the rest of the people, and the tax that each had to give to the central authority of the Mishkan, the sanctuary, the tabernacle, and various and sundry details related to that. What comes along with this is the command to cleanse and purge vessels made of metal that were taken in the spoils of war. And from here we learn not just about spoils of war, but we learn about the method of making kosher vessels that have become non-kosher, as well as purifying vessels that have become defiled to contact with a dead body. Okay, there's more to say, but we'll move on, because this next part is very powerful. The Torah tells us that the tribes of Reuven and Gad had a tremendous amount, a tremendous number of flocks of sheep and goats, one assumes. And they saw the land which they had recently conquered on the east side of the Jordan River to be particularly good for grazing. So leaders of the children of Gad and the children of Reuven came to Moshe, to Elazar, to the leaders of the people, saying the following. These various city-states here, this area is terrific for raising sheep, raising flocks and herds, and we've got a lot of animals. So they said, if it finds pleasure in your eyes, give us this land as our heritage, and not that we should go across the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. Moshe says to the tribes of Gad and Reuven, he blows up. He says, your brethren are going to face wars and battles, and you're going to sit here? And besides that, why are you trying to encourage the people not to cross the Jordan? This is what your fathers did with the whole business of the spies that I sent out, Moshe said, and they went here and there, and they came back, and they said it's not a good place to be, and here we go again. You're doing it again. I can't believe you're doing it again. And the anger seeps through here, the justifiable anger, that these people who have been wandering for 40 years to be brought into the land of Canaan said, you know what, we'd rather stay here. So they said, oh, wait a minute. You know what? We'll build corrals and pens for our animals and cities for our children and families, and we will arm ourselves with the people of Israel, the rest of the tribes, and we will go across the Jordan with them, and our families will stay back here, and we will not return to our homes until Eretz Yisrael proper is settled, each person according to the land which he is to receive. We would not think of settling here before we help the rest of our people to settle then. So Moshe softens and says, okay, if you're going to do that, then you will come armed and fight together with your brethren, conquer the land, and afterwards you will return here, v'hiyitem nekiyim mehashem umi Yisrael. And by that, you will be clean in God's eyes and in the eyes of Israel. Side point. It's not such a side point. It's a major point. A Jew must behave in a way that is not only proper before God, but it has to have the appearance of propriety before his fellow people. One of the things that comes out of this is the concept called Ma'arit Ayin. Ma'arit Ayin is doing something that's acceptable, but it looks like you're doing the wrong thing and giving people the wrong impression. Simple example, and it changes as time goes on. Once upon a time, relatively speaking, a long time ago, anything that looked like butter was butter, and it was dairy. And with the advent of non-dairy margarine, the use of margarine with meat raised eyebrows, because it looked so much like butter. And the ruling was, at the time, that the wrapping or the container of margarine that says on it pariv should be on the table when somebody is eating that which is margarine acceptable to be eaten with meat. I'll give you a better example. I don't know why I didn't choose it in the first place. When coffee lighteners first came out, the non-dairy coffee lighteners, they raised eyebrows when people lightened their coffee after a meat meal. And in the early days, catering halls were required to have the containers on the table that said Parv Rich's cream or whatever. And only then did the rabbis give permission, the various kashrut supervisors, to be used at meat meals. I remember some of the catering halls, they didn't want a container of one of the products sitting on the table, so they had coffee creamers engraved with the word parv, and that was deemed acceptable as well. I say times have changed because margarine is just as common as butter, and non-dairy creamers are well known, but each generation has its own new things that raise eyebrows. Even when the Shabbos clock first started. Once upon a time, a long time ago, if lights went off in someone's home on a Friday night, you wondered, I thought they were religious, what are they turning off lights for? Now, and already for many years, you see lights going off in someone's home Friday night or any night, you assume it's a clock. Oh, they're probably not home, their lights just went off. So, it's no longer Marit Ayin, but once upon a time it was. The point is, if a person does something which is 100% acceptable, halachically permissible, kosher, whatever, but it looks like he might be doing the wrong thing, then that's a problem too, and the problem traces back, in part, to this statement. Moshe says, if you will do this, you will be clean in God's perspective and that of Israel. And then this land shall be yours. And if you won't do that, then that will be considered a terrible sin against the people, and you're not going to be allowed to settle here. This concept, this whole piece of B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, who are later joined by half of Shevet Menashe, is nonetheless still an irksome topic. Because they shouldn't have asked that. They asked it, Moshe got justifiably angry, things were calmed down, and they ended up getting permission. But it would be translated into modern times of Jews saying, I know that God wants us to live in Israel, but I would rather stay here. And Moshe Rabbeinu's objection is overcome by these people by writing checks and buying bonds and supporting institutions in Israel, but it's still the same idea. We have many flocks, much flocks, and we want to stay outside of Israel proper. The irony is that that part became a part of Eretz Yisrael, but not the main part. So it's a problematic issue. Okay, we're winding down, so let's go from the Sedra to the 3 weeks. First of all, basically Ashkenazim hold restrictions during the full 3 week period, but they go in gradations. From Shivat Aser B'Tammuz until the first of Av, the beginning of the 3 weeks, we'll call it, is one level of restriction. Then things get more serious during the 9 days from Rosh Chodesh Av. Then there's an intensification of mournful practices in the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, and then Erev Tisha B'Av and Tisha B'Av itself. So there's a gradation. Sfaradim generally do not have restrictions during the first part of the 3 weeks and begin only with Rosh Chodesh Av, as is mentioned in the Mishnah. As far as Ashkenazim are concerned, there are no marriages during this period, but engagements are permitted and I think even encouraged. Hair cutting is not permitted as far as shaving. Some hold that it is part of the concept of hair cutting, and therefore there's no shaving either. Others claim that a clean-shaven person in our time, when he shaves daily, it's like washing his face. It's not the grooming that once upon a time, or that is still practiced by people who wear beards. So if you wear a beard, whatever you call it, I know you call it a beard, it's the wearing, if that's the right term. If you have a beard, then there is no permission for shaving or trimming, because that's part of the hair cutting grooming. If you're clean shaven, you need to ask a halachic authority if you can shave or not, and there are factors such as where you work and what's expected at the job and different things like that. Aside from that, there is an offshoot of the prohibition of weddings because of the festivities at a wedding, specifically live band and peppy music with dancing and singing, and therefore that became not just at a wedding, but any kind of music and concerts are not appropriate for the 3 weeks. And the question about recorded music, some say no, some say yes. Privacy of your own headphones versus public listening. There are various shades of this. We'll have to do more of this next week when we have more time. I could just say, which to me is a strong bottom line, the Gemara says, all who mourn the destruction of Jerusalem will be privileged to see its rejoicing and rebuilding. And I would like to be part of that. And I think we all would like to be part of that. And therefore, mourning in these various and sundry token ways, and mostly in our mind, is a very important thing to keep in mind for this period of the year. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Lehishtamea.